This is the Car Dealer Podcast driven by CarGurus. You want the best return for your advertising budgets, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast. If you haven't listened before, we pick our favourite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me is a man you'd all forgotten about. For one week only, it's founder of Car Dealer Magazine, James Baggett. James, where have you been? Well, you're on mute, so that's a really good start.
I've forgotten how to do a podcast. This is brilliant, isn't it? What a start. You can see why I'd been fired for the last 2 weeks, don't you? I have been all over the place, John, including to Beamish Open Air Museum in the north as part of an EV road trip, which was delightful. I'm lying. Don't drive anywhere in an EV in the UK because it is a massive headache. And guess what car I did it in, John? I think probably people on the podcast will know, because I'm sure, having listened to a couple of the last ones, you have told them, haven't you?
Yes, it is the Korean Mercedes that is the Genesis.
Yeah.
The GV? What is it?
GV? It was a GV60. Yes, it was the Genesis, which is a posh Korean car, which is a bit of an oxymoron, isn't it? Because those things do not exist.
Well, they do, and they're on sale, and they're called Genesis.
Yes, exactly.
John,
I've spoken to you at length, haven't I, about my thoughts on Genesis, and now I've got real-world, first-hand experience of having driven one about 700 miles, and I can tell you my thoughts have not changed. It was not a pleasant car, and I have no idea why anybody would spend £70,000 on this model over an Audi or a Mercedes or a BMW, because they just won't.
I'll give you, I didn't realise it was 70. Is it really 70 grand?
67,000 pounds.
Yeah, that is a bit chunky for what is ostensibly quite a small car. Well, okay, it's not that small, is it? But you went with your small family, as it were, didn't you? One baby, one mother, and all the baby essentials. And did they all fit into this 67,000 pound car?
Not really, John. Not really. But I must say, so this was a feature that Rebecca was writing all about using the UK charging infrastructure. And we had to exclusively use GridSurf charging points. And we were actually quite lucky. I mean, some of them were as bad as you would expect, you know, as in the fact that they were either not working properly or they were very busy. But the ones that we did use, they were 150 kilowatt chargers. And quite a few times we managed to plug into them and make it work. And we were getting 125, 130 kilowatt charge times, which actually did make it possible to do it in the time it takes to go into the services and have a coffee and a very short break. And it's, when that works, and if there was loads of them, then I can see it making EVs a little bit more usable. But the problem is there's not many of them. And actually, the amount of services we went to, whether there was lots of people there or the chargers weren't working properly, far outweighed the ones where it did. So my sort of thoughts remain on the public charging infrastructure. It's not quite yet there yet.
Well, much as I would love to quiz you on your further thoughts about both Genesis and EVs, I will talk about one other thing that you've been up to, which is launching another podcast.
Thank you for mentioning, John. Yes, indeed, I have. Yes, we, in the last couple of days, no, when was it? Back end of last week, I think we published the first in this series. It's called the Car Dealer Inspiring Leaders Podcast, and it's where I talk to 10 inspiring car dealer leaders. The first podcast was the Smythe family, the trio of brothers who run Swansway Garages. And this is all about inspiring the next generation of automotive leaders, talking about how these great people in our industry have got to the positions that they're in, and the sort of ethos and the things that they've learned and picked up and tips along the way that they've helped them get to their position that they can pass on to the next generation. And I think that the chat that I had with Smythe Brothers, as you can imagine, was quite entertaining. It was great fun chatting to those three. They had some really interesting things to say. And I've got some great people coming up on that podcast. John O'Hanlon, I've recorded. I've spoken to Stephen Eagle. I've got Darren Edwards from Sitna lined up, as well as many more that are going to be released over the next few months. So you can find that on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or it's also on our YouTube channel. And I think it's sort of linked to this podcast in some way, John. Am I right?
I think it is on Apple. You can find it quite easily if you're an Apple podcaster, which the majority of our listeners are, I can tell you from our statistics. then yes, you can find it quite easily.
Excellent. Well, thank you for
definitely
that.
Worth a listen, I can
thank
say.
Thank you for the opportunity to plug it. Much appreciated.
No problem. Well, I will move on and introduce our guest, who is Nick McDonald, Director of the Compliance Guys. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you.
So, sorry you had to listen to that, Nick, that massive rambling intro from John and I, but welcome.
Well, do you know what? To give my quick 2 pence worth on EVs, my wife has got a Tesla Model 3, and my business partner's got a Taycan. And I will say that Tesla's charging infrastructure is what makes Tesla the number one. It's simply that. If I take the Tesla anywhere, I know that every other motorway services will have a charger available almost always, a fast one at that, and I don't have to worry about it. Whereas John with his Taycan is always, is this going to work? Where's there going to be one? And, you know, with a third of the UK housing stock not having off-street parking, I take it, yes, you should be able to charge overnight, but we still need that to be up to speed.
You've absolutely hit the nail on the head there, because during this journey, every services we stopped at had obviously a huge bank of Tesla chargers. And whereas we are going into a services that's got may have two normal public chargers, there are 8 Tesla ones, with a couple of them being used. And I think that there's never anybody battling for them. Okay, we saw a few headlines, didn't we, over Christmas at the really busy points. But majority of the time, they're available, easy to use. And it's been built into that whole ecosystem of Tesla, which is, I think, why they've been so successful.
It even puts it into your sat-nav, of course, tells you how long for, and it does make it as seamless as possible.
Very nerdily as well, when you tell it you're going to go to a charge point, it asks if you want to pre-prepare the battery for fast charging and heats it up itself. So it's ready to put the maximum level of juice in, because, of course, they don't like being cold, do they, EV batteries? So it's all very clever and integrated.
Yeah, that is clever.
Yeah, nobody else has worked out to do. Anyway, off EVs, the Compliance Guys. So tell us a bit about what you do. I mean, the name is a slight giveaway, but what sort of services do you offer?
Well, obviously, we're not the first compliance company to do, you know, automotive financial services stuff, but we've taken a bit of a different angle. So there are already some big companies, majority looking after manufacturers, you know, or franchises, and general insurance, which is heavily in that industry. Over half the cars and the used cars in the UK are sold by independent dealers, and their compliance has generally been shocking, to be frank. You know, I think part of it's they've been afraid of doing compliance, they've been overlooked, or it's not the most profitable market. Of course, it's easier to deal with less customers for more money, you know, but that's the area me and John were already in previous work. So that's what we've done. You know, we like to think we've taken compliance to the masses, and that's a great great thing for the industry. So we offer 4 different services effectively. One is authorization support for dealers, brokers, and lenders. We then do ongoing compliance support packages for directly authorized businesses, mostly dealers and brokers. And we also have a small appointed representative network for those who want to de-risk and do it themselves. And the key thing is that we don't handle general insurance, or certainly not from an ongoing support point of view, which most of the independents aren't really doing. They're either an AR for insurance or just don't offer it. So that simplifies the journey somewhat, which is what, you know, they like. You can now do a 5 minute compliance journey, maybe rather than a 45 minutes compliance journey, which fits with that market. And the fourth thing we've got is our new test drive app, which is just trying to improve the compliance around checking people's driving licenses up front, handling data, and trying to bring that great digital journey that everyone's got onto the forecourt so that we're capturing data in a modern way and also a compliant way.
I must say the whole area of compliance is something that I'm sure James is probably the same. We don't really think about as people having to go through on a daily basis, but it is a terrifying area. I mean, I'm terrified of things like the ICO and the FCA. Obviously, we don't have anything to do with finance, so the FCA don't have anything to do with us. But the thought of doing all that is pretty hideous. I mean, at the end of this month, there's a looming deadline, isn't there, for certain things? Consumer duty?
It is, yeah.
So what actually does that entail? Because I, layman as I am, I had a look at the details of it, and I can't make head nor tail of.
I always think that's the intention. Quite cynically, I think that's the intention to keep people like me in a job. I'll try and simplify consumer duty quickly. I think what it gets away from is what I would call tick box compliance. So in the past, it's have you got policies and procedures? Can you tick a box to say that the customer understood something? And now we're working out, did the customer understand something, for instance, and can we prove it with data? And what I like about this is it's moving away from he said, she said to let's see what the data says. Are overall customers getting a good service? And if not, how can we improve it over time? And I like that constant improvement rather than, just working on individual issues.
Can you give me an idea of what a dealer could do wrong under these new sets of regulations? I mean, where's the biggest red flag that dealers need to worry about?
Well, one, not taking it seriously. I think the first thing is that car dealers tell us we're already doing these things. So the four categories are products and services. So are you doing the right products? Price and value. Are you offering the right price and value? And to be fair, those two will look after themselves to some degree if you want to be competitive. And then you've got consumer understanding and consumer support. And ultimately, people are like, well, we're already doing all these things. So the biggest red flag or the biggest pitfall is not recording the information correctly or not having the right management information to check whether the customer outcomes are good and therefore making the improvements.
Yeah, because I think there seems to be quite a lot of misunderstanding. And I think with these sorts of things, a lot of people just kick the can down the road a little bit, don't they? They think, well, it's 10 days away. This is coming in. It's coming in quickly. If you think most dealers are doing it, is there anything to worry about, or is it a case of just crack on with what you're doing?
It's definitely not crack on with what you're doing. But I would say see it as an opportunity to improve your business more than anything. Like there's certainly the four areas you'd look at if you were trying to improve or even buy a business. Is, you know, what products you're selling, how much for. Is your marketing and other consumer understanding good? And are you looking after your customers? So they're not bad things to look at. But, you know, realistically, if you take compliance hand in hand with business, if you're looking at those good customer outcomes, you're going to improve your business along the way. But, you know, we're still getting people now, you know, with 10 days left coming to us and going, what's this consumer duty thing that's going on? You know, and that is the independence. And, you know, that's why we're here. But, yeah, the main thing is just to see it as something that's ongoing, but don't be scared of it. Just make sure you've got the right systems, the right data in place to record, and then get review points to make sure that you're showing that you're doing something. But that's got to be better than just endless paperwork and box ticking to prove that you've done something.
Is there any examples you can give us, not naming any names, obviously, of people that have done stuff incorrectly up until now that are now going to change it? I mean, what sort of policies and things is this actually going to change on a practical level?
Okay, I'm going to take this out of the motor industry, which is probably a sensible thing to do right now, but it's related. I am going to question whether car insurance providers are fair under consumer duty to price differently according to how close you are to the renewal time. So if you think about the product and the price, if I renew 45 days before my policy is due, I get one price. If I renew 5 days before, it's now a bigger price. So I would like to know how that is fair based on risk and not just in the interests of business. So what Consumer Duty wants is the profitability and actual customer outcomes are aligned, and one isn't favoured more than the other. I think that's a glaring example of where it's, you know, and the other big thing is, of course, what they call vulnerable customers, which are actually vulnerable situations. But if you've got a customer who pays their car insurance annually, they may not have saved up enough money, or they may be still making a payment on their insurance 2 months before renewal. So why should they be penalized that they are only being able to renew closer to the time? So I think that's a good example.
Yeah, I mean, I've long hated the way that insurance providers for a while used to give you a worse price if you were an existing customer to when you were a new one. And then there was recent regulation changes, wasn't there, in the last few years that changed that. And now every policy I get for every renewal is actually cheaper than the last year. I mean, it's been an amazing change that. So there
Just because you're getting old, James.
Yeah, it's probably quite a lot to do with it, and the fact I don't use any of my cars or motorbikes. But I think that has been one practical change that has been for the better. Do you think that off the back of this, we're going to see some more, for want of a better term, ambulance chasing cases like we've had with the interest payments? You know, there was this big disclosure, wasn't there, for a long time about were the interest rate. No, it wasn't the interest rates. It was more the commission, wasn't it?
Well, differential
commission that dealers were getting, the commission disclosure. And we're seeing lots of dealers getting targeted for that. Mm-hmm. Do you think these new regulations are going to cause any things to worry about along those sorts of levels if dealers don't follow them?
I don't, actually. And I think that's because we're getting away from, was this a good outcome? So what the FCA initially proposed, that they said best outcome under Consumer Duty, and they've moved to good outcome. So if the dealer can prove that the outcome was good or reasonably good, then you can't just say it had to be perfect. And the other thing is, if you know, the FCA rules still are in place, so people still got to do the right things. But ultimately, it will be, can you prove overall that you're looking after your customers or that you're improving it? And I think that's going to be very difficult for ambulance chasers to actually not go after an individual case, but they may have to go after a business and say the business isn't doing this overall. And I think that's going to be really difficult to do. I think the other thing is the ambulance chasers go after the easiest pickings, and they thought that was going to be the motor trade. And as I understand it, a lot of those are being batted off, and I think they'll back off. But you've got industries like funeral planning that have come heavily under scrutiny, debt services, like people selling IVA leads. So there are some other areas of financial services where I think there are more cowboys, certainly in our industry, there definitely are. And I hope, and I do think that that means that we'll get left alone a little bit over the next few years.
Interesting. Well, it sounds like you're going to have a very busy next 10 days. Is it like the end of the financial year for accountants? It's just they're there 23 hours of the day working on people's accounts. Is that you and your firm at the moment?
Well, it has been for probably the last 8-9 months. I think, you know, really November, December is where people started really taking this seriously. And yeah, certainly at the moment, the last 2 months from the dealer point of view, who leave it a bit later than brokers, it's been absolutely crazy. I wouldn't like it to slow down in August because it's all nice, good income. But I think it will slow down a bit in August, and then we'll look after the ongoing stuff.
Very good.
And then maybe you can take a well-deserved holiday.
Another one. I had one in July, which I'm like, you had a holiday in July. I'm like, yeah, it wasn't great planning, but there you go.
Or you could look at it on the flip side, very good planning. Just leaving it. Yeah, I think so.
Absolutely. Just before we move on, what's your background, Nick? How did you start in this industry? Well, this bit of the industry.
Well, I was car sales, so worked for what was CD Bramalls, which then became Evans Halshaw, used car supermarket up in York, then for Peugeot, and then I moved to working in motor finance, and that's where we ended up learning all the FCA stuff. And then I left and just consulted on financial compliance for 5 years, and then when COVID hit, I thought, wow, what's going on? I need to formalize this so it looks a bit more professional. And then it just grew legs, to be honest. Over the last 3 years, it went from me sitting covered in yogurt from my kids during lockdown to we've now got 18 staff, I think, 2 offices and, you know, nearly 1,000 customers. So it's, wow. It's gone a bit crazy. So I don't know how I got here, actually. It's the truth.
Well, huge congratulations on that growth. I mean, do you miss car sales at all? I mean, it's a slightly different part of the industry you're working in now, isn't it?
Well, I'm close enough to, I think, still enjoy it to some degree. So, you know, I still take calls all the time of dealers asking what's happening, you know, what's the advice on this and stuff. And, you know, we go on bangers for Ben and, you know, we're still massively involved, probably more. We see ourselves almost more as motor trade than we do as compliance. Mm. But do I miss selling three cars on a Saturday and then going and enjoying that first pint? Yeah, definitely. I think anybody who's sold cars misses that.
Yeah, I'll bet. Right, John, shall we?
Yes, let's. So if you haven't listened before, James and I have chosen our favourite stories from the car dealer website this week. We don't know what each other has chosen, and we're going to have a chat about each story as we go through. At the end, Nick gets to decide whose stories were the best and who is the winner. If you want to play along, you can tweet at Car Dealer Mag and let us know if you think we've missed any stories. James Batchelor won last week. So, James, you're going to go first.
Wow. Thank you. What an honour. What an honour. Well, thank you, John. Glad to be back for 1 week only before I go on holiday. Very much looking forward to that. So that's where I'll be for the next 2 weeks, and I won't be reading any of the stories. So I've been writing lots of them this week, and I'm not going to pick a news story. I'm going to pick more of a sort of an investigation-style piece that I wrote earlier this week. Little self-plug there. But this is about agency sales. And it's one that we've been wanting to do for a while, isn't it? We wanted to know where all the manufacturers stand on their agency sales and their agency sales plans. So I sent an email to every one of the 47 car brands operating in the UK, a very simple email to their press office saying, when will you move to agency sales? I can only imagine the fear that email panic that caused in some press offices. Oh, they want an answer at last. I could feel the fear come through some of these replies that I had through. And actually, by the fact that I was ignored by many manufacturers says a lot. So off the back of that, we managed to come up with a table of where people stand, some of them, where some of these car manufacturers stand. So as we know now, 18 car manufacturers have or soon will be moving to this fixed price, no haggle agency sales agreements, whatever you want to call them. That includes Mini, Skoda, which is a new brand that we'd heard about that is going to be moving this year. Smart and Genesis, they're all going to swap to agency sales within the next 6 months. BMW said they're going to follow Mini suit in 2026. But only 8 car manufacturers, John, said they will definitely not do agency sales. That included some we'd already heard about. So people like MG, who have been very, very much against it. And there was a couple of others, including the likes of Lamborghini and Ferrari, some of those high-end manufacturers. 21 car manufacturers either failed to comment on their plans when we asked them or chose not to issue a statement to car dealer. So there needs to be a bit of a distinction between those two replies, because failed to respond was they simply ignored my email and thought it was better not to say anything at all or engage. Whereas the ones that chose not to issue a statement was a little bit more telling, because those are the people that I came back with an answer, a bit like Stellantis. And I said, well, hang on a minute, you haven't mentioned all your other passenger car brands here. And they said, we're not going to comment any further. So read into that what you will. So in total, the results were 18 said they are going to be going to agency sales. 8 said no, 15 failed to respond, and 6 issued a no comment. So there's some interesting data there. We've got a full list of what each manufacturer said or didn't say on that story on the website. And there's some nice commentary from some experts on what it says. I think the commentator, the one that I really paid attention to was the comments from David Kendrick, who said these really do just point. What was most interesting about these results were the people who didn't say anything rather than the people who did, because what are they doing? Are they Are they watching the market and seeing how others are doing? Are they looking over at Mercedes and seeing how they're performing? Or are they simply just not going to do it? So I think there'll be a lot of people looking at these results. There'll be a lot of dealers out there who probably know a little bit more than we do about what's going to happen in the next few years and see who's going to be moving towards agency sales. But it's the big talking point at the moment. I stick by my points that I've made in previous podcasts. Every dealer that I've spoken to so far doesn't like agency sales. They're just being forced to say publicly, they're a great idea. Thank you, Mr. Manufacturer. Please don't remove my franchise. But privately, on the phone, and in text messages, on email to me, they're not happy. And I think a lot of people are sort of hoping it's going to fail. And they're looking at Mercedes numbers at the moment and thinking, well, they don't look great. So is that going to stop my manufacturer making that decision? So some very interesting results there. We will continue to update that table as we hear more. And if manufacturers do come back to us, I was waiting when we published that story, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday this week, for my inbox to just go crazy with all these manufacturers screaming at me. I didn't get one email. No, tell a lie. I got one email and it was from Ford, which basically said, no comment. So they'd missed the deadline by that point, but we know Ford, and I'd mentioned it in the story, are heading to agency sales. So why they didn't say that, I don't know. But there's a lot of fear out there, isn't there? There's a lot of different forces working against each other here. There's the dealers on one side saying that they have to like it but don't really like it. You've got the manufacturers who are saying, oh, it's what the customer wants, but it's not what the customer wants, but it is what the customer wants, but it really means we're going to make loads more money. So there's just it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. What did you think?
I had two takeaways from this. One is, as you've mentioned there, the numbers of yes, no, fails to respond, no comment, whatever. When you look at the pie chart that we've given our readers, the majority, if you take away the fail to respond, the majority is yes. 18 yes, 8 no. So that is quite a severe majority going to yes, we are going to implement agency sales. And then we've got no comment of another 6. So if you interpret no comment as probably yes, that's sort of even more, isn't it? I'm not necessarily saying that that's what all those people who said no comment are, but you can sort of sometimes take that as read, can't you? The other takeaway I've got is why 15 failed to respond and 6 no comments. Why are manufacturers scared of saying one way or the other that they're going to do it? Is it easy that they're scared and they don't want an uprising of dealers, as it were, but I don't think that's not really a possibility anyway? Or is it that they simply haven't formulated what on earth they're doing? Do they all want to do it, but it's just such an upheaval that they haven't quite worked out how to do it?
Yeah, I think it's probably the fact that it is such a hot topic. It's so contentious with these dealers and the manufacturers that is probably why they're not wanting to say anything. The interesting one for me was the Volkswagen Group response. They said that Skoda is going to go live with agency sales before the end of 2023. But for all of their other brands, Volkswagen, Audi, they said these are going to happen after Skoda. So I said, well, what does after Skoda mean? Well, you know, when is that? Is that this year? Is that next year? It's after Skoda, James. So, okay, I'm going to assume that is going to be next year. No, that's after Skoda, James. And, I went back and asked these questions again and again. So why aren't they saying when this is going to happen? If it's after Skoda, is it definitely going to happen? Which we know. We know it's been delayed already. We're reporting on the fact that there has been problems with it. But why not give it some timeline? You know, the dealers need to know this. And I'm pretty sure customers want to know too.
Maybe customers aren't quite so bothered. Because they don't, it's a bit like the thing of when customers walk into a dealership, they think they're buying from Skoda. They don't think they're buying from Marshall or whoever. They don't generally have an understanding of who they're dealing with. To an extent, it's not going to make any difference for them. They go in, they want to buy a car. It makes the difference in terms of the haggle thing is going to change. But majoritatively, it's all behind the scenes stuff that they're not aware of.
Yeah, I suppose so. What they will be aware of is walking into a showroom and saying, I would like to buy that car, please. And they go, we can't actually buy that car. You have to go onto our website to buy that car. And it's not actually that car. It's going to be another one that's going to be delivered from somewhere else. It's this confusion that people go, hang on a minute. You know what it's like? If you walk into a shop and you go, I'd like to buy that. Oh, you can't buy that. It's a display model. Yeah, but it's there. I want to take it home now. No, you can't have that. You have to order it from a warehouse. It just, I don't think it really is the thing that pleases consumers. I can't see it being better. I can't see it being better, but you know, that's my take on it. Nick, what did you think? Did you read this piece and what were your kind of thoughts on it?
Well, I think my thoughts were even stronger than John's on the percentage. If you take out actually Ferrari, Lamborghini and Maserati, I think were the three that were pointed out, that percentage becomes more stark. And those three premium luxury manufacturers, it makes complete sense that they need the skill of a product demonstrator, probably wouldn't even call them a salesman, to go over the detail of the order and that kind of thing. So
more like a concierge, isn't it?
Yeah. Once you take those out, of course, it means that most volume manufacturers are moving to this. And we know it's for money, like you've said. I actually have a personal experience where I can see from a consumer point of view where agency to some degree could work. So Volvo, I was looking at an XC90 last year, and they just released the hybrid one. I wanted the tax efficiencies through the business, obviously, and they were not available realistically. So I said, rang one of the Volvo sites, and have you got any available? No. So as a consumer, I went to the Volvo website and thought, right, let me have a look at what UK stock there is sat at dealers that I could buy, and I couldn't find out. I had to click through to every single franchise's website, hope that they listed new car stock. They could have an online system, but most I had to then call. And after searching through maybe 20, I thought, I'm going to give up, and I bought a BMW X5 instead. So you can see there from Volvo's point of view, that would be, well, you know, if we've got a way of controlling that new car stock, we may have sold another car. And so I think online, it almost makes more sense. But in the dealership, you like you said, you know, you want to be able to see what product is actually there. So I do think it needs a little bit more thought from that point of view.
That is a very interesting example. I think from my point of view, I think it needs to be a combination. I get that some people would like to buy cars online. They like to do the research and they'd like to order it. And actually, I do sort of get the point of fixed prices. You do it with things like your iPhone, etc., which is examples we've used in the past. But what I do think you need to be able to do, just as you can, taking that Apple analogy even further, you need to be able to walk into a store, talk to an expert and go, yeah, actually, I do want that. And they go, yeah, okay, no problems. Here, take payment here and you can walk out of the shop with it. If it is that sort of omni-channel approach, if you can still walk into a dealer and I don't care how they order the car, if they have to go onto the Volvo website and order it themselves, but if I can still deal with that person and he can look after the whole sale, that's when it works for me. Which is, I can't see how that is different to what we're doing at the moment. All the only difference is fixed price. But it's where they say, and you had this problem in Mercedes for a while, you'd walk into the Mercedes showroom and they'd say, you can't order it here, sir. You have to go online and do that. And then the customer goes, well, that's rubbish. And they walk over the road to the Audi dealership. So I think this, you're right, it needs some finessing. And if we get to this, something similar to what we've got now, but fixed price, then maybe it'll work.
We'll be right back. You want the best return from your advertising budget, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market, high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you. Now, let's get back to the quiz.
Interesting. Well, we will keep that story updated with any more that come through. But I'm not holding my breath, put it that way. I think there's just going to be some quiet reveals over the next few months of who's doing it and who isn't.
I think you're right. Well, maybe we'll repeat the research next year, John.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to move us on then. I am going to also talk about an investigation piece. We seem to have quite a lot on the website this week, actually. I say that as though we don't always have quite a lot on the website, but we are well filled with stories for this July week. So this is an investigation carried out by Jim Holder, who's writing lots of things for us. And it's about who is, well, the title is, who is driving the anti-electric car agenda, James, and why? And the sort of the crux
how
of
dare
it,
you? How dare you? This is a balanced piece of, before you go on, this is a balanced piece of journalism that was commissioned by me for Cardinal magazine. So how dare you say that I am a media baron pushing the anti-EV agenda? Please carry on.
You wish you're a media baron. So this is talking about EVs have got had a lot of bad press. In particular, the 2030-2035 ban has had a lot of bad press. So depending on who you talk to, some people will say, well, that's because we are not set up for the 2030 ban, and this is ridiculous, and we need to either postpone the ban, or we need to put more charge points in, et cetera, et cetera, or we need to incentivize new EV purchases. There's lots of things that need to happen. But there's a few people who suggest that perhaps I'm going to quote Quentin Wilson here, not the one man who was on our podcast last week, but the real Quentin Wilson, who is a spokesman for the EV lobby group Fair Charge UK. And he describes the press around and the press coverage around the EV ban as an incredible tirade against EVs and the ban, and openly questioned what has triggered such relentless negativity, as he puts it. So, I mean, on my front, I kind of think partially, yes, are there some negative forces at play in terms of, I don't know, I don't want to say oil companies are anti-EV, because I think a lot of them are adapting to EVs and investing some money in EV infrastructure and green energy and all this sort of stuff. But I think a lot of it actually comes down to people are scared of what is going to happen. And as your experience has proved, there's still uncertainty about how you're going to go about your current daily routine with an EV, and is it possible? So I think you could say there are perhaps lobbyists push the EV ban further back, but I think also it does reflect a lot of national sentiment in terms of, I drive a petrol car every day, how's my life going to change if I can't plug in because I live in a terraced house and all this sort of thing? So I think there's a bit of a mix of both. But anyway, I think this is a very interesting piece to read, and I would advise you to go and do it, because he's spoken to Ray Massey of the Daily Mail, who unsurprisingly is quite anti the 2030 EV ban. Surprising one is the Petrol Retailing Association are actually sort of behind it. They are, so this is the body that represents petrol stations across the UK and therefore oil companies. And they are generally sort of the mind that it's happening and we have to embrace it. They've said, we are committed to embracing the transition towards electrification by 2030. We recognise the importance of adapting to evolving market demands, and our members have already taken significant steps in this direction. Many PRA members have already begun installing charge points on their forecourts. It's very true. However, they have pointed to a few teething problems. Mm. So they are saying that it takes substantial investment. I'm sure this is something that dealers will agree with. In order to get yourself ready for mass EV adoption, huge amounts of money have to be spent on their forecourts and putting in all these chargers. And there's not really a huge amount of support from the government or otherwise in terms of actually doing that. So there's expensive upgrades and they take a long time to actually pay off, if you see what I mean. So that was their take on it. James, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this story.
I have got a lot of thoughts on this story. And I'm very, very pleased that we ran it. I mean, it only went out this morning, and my Twitter feed has gone absolutely ballistic off the back of it. And there's some interesting people. There's lots of people who've sort of weighed into the argument from both sides. Those EV evangelists, the people, the EV haters. And they've obviously a bit of an argument going on. But I think Ray Massey, who is quoted in that piece, and the Daily Mail has been very much against EVs over the last few weeks. There was a week-long series of articles, including a couple of front pages, two of which we've used in our article, that were very much against it. I mean, the fact that it's on the front page of the Daily Mail says a lot. You know, that is, it is Middle England. They like to think that they're reporting what a large majority of the UK population is thinking. And Ray's tweeted in response to this, that to us, he said there's a huge people saying that there's a, you know, there's too much evangelists about EVs. He said there's a huge difference between journalism and evangelism. Early adopters in the EV community appear miffed that their monopoly on the faith is lost. He says the mainstream consumer issue for millions of motorists is needs to be reported on. He says they are, it's right and proper to expose these uncomfortable truths, are his words. That's the function of a free, feisty and independent press and media. So he's sticking by the fact that the reason that they're reporting on this is because a lot of the EV side of things is not working. I mean, we know that. I mean, actually, the government does need to be pushed further into getting more of a charging infrastructure out there. The order take for new EVs is falling. That has made some headlines this week. The used car prices of EVs has absolutely plummeted. So it's not all rosy out there. It's not all rosy. But I am a big believer that we do need change. And I think the thing that's missing, and this is the point for me, the thing that's missing is we seem to have lost the green message. You know, we seem to have lost the fact that replacing a petrol or diesel car with one that is zero emissions, and that is the important term, zero emissions, is better for air quality. It is better for the environment. Okay, you can have the argument about how they're made, etc. But you've only got to look across to Europe and the huge increase they've had in temperatures in the last week, and this huge heat wave they're having, and all the things that I've been reading and listening to on the radio has all been about climate change and how we're going to miss this target of only a 1.5 degree rise by a long way. That was a big piece on the radio yesterday. Well, electric cars and zero emissions is a big part of helping to reduce those emissions and helping impact climate change. And I just feel that is the bit that's disappeared. Nobody's talking about the green benefits anymore. They're talking about the fact that EVs don't work, etc. And I mean, I'm sure we are probably guilty of it just as much. I don't know, John, is that something you've noticed or is it just me?
The lack of green element. I think partially, I think the green argument slightly, I don't want to say it disappears, but people forget about it in difficult times. So climate change is something that everyone has known about for at least 20, 30 years. It's been, scientists have known about it for much longer than that. And I think probably it's a convenient one to forget every time there's something like a recession or a cost of living crisis, or, you know, it's that sort of thing. It's, well, that's all well and good, me installing a heat pump for $9,000, but how am I going to afford the electricity for it? It's that sort of thing. I think you ultimately, as human beings, we put our own needs first at the end of the day, rather than something that which can wait for later, don't we? So I think there's that element. It's interesting to, on Ray's tweet, in terms of journalism versus activism or whatever it is he said, I think I was, as you were saying that, I was thinking to myself, of all the, you know, the pool of journalists that we're in, motoring journalists as a whole are, generally speaking, petrol heads, for want of a better word, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
They all like cars. They got into this because they like cars. And generally, if you like cars, or you've started in this industry a few years ago, you like petrol and diesel engines. And I don't think anyone, you know, we as a motoring journalist community have to review the products as they are. So we're delivered an EV and we have to evaluate it on its strengths and weaknesses in that package, don't we? We can't put in the review. We can't review a VW ID4 or something. Is that a thing? Yes. ID4 electric car and say it's rubbish because the grid surf charger we plugged it into wasn't working. Yeah. So we've got to evaluate on the grounds of the product, haven't we? But that's why there's lots of positive reviews and things of all these EVs, because they're all quite good. It's just that, unfortunately, when you then take it out of the grounds of this review of the car, there's all these other problems to deal with, such as charging it. And I think perhaps if we were a bit better sorted, putting it lightly, on the charging front, this wouldn't be such a problem. I don't think anyone will be panicking about the switch to EVs if there was a really easy, definitely going to work charger on every corner, and people felt confident in the fact that they could plug it in overnight and wouldn't have a problem. I think if you took that element away, people would not be so worried about it. I think if this was, you have to buy a Tesla after 2030 and there's no other choice, I don't think people would be quite so worried about it. I think it wouldn't be, I think you get the occasional people going, I love my petrol engine and, you know, I don't give up the sound of it, which is a valid but stupid point. But the fear element, I think, would go. And how do you, continuing my rant on EV chargers, I think, and this won't appease the Daily Mail, but I think, how do you make that happen? We have tried to let the market work it out. The market has not worked it out properly. I think you have to do it, firstly, with a bit of regulation in terms of all chargers need to behave in this way and need to have this amount of uptime, we're starting to see that. But then also the government has to acknowledge that it can't just be the market that sorts it out, because things like the national grid are not ready for suddenly all of these companies to start putting EV chargers in everywhere.
The thing with this piece, John, and the headline sort of obviously sums it up: who's driving the anti-electric car agenda and why? I mean, this is what they're what Jim was trying to get to the bottom of, is because the sentiment has definitely changed, and we've talked about this before on the podcast. From the turn of the year, we've seen lots of negative headlines. I mean, it started with all those people queuing up over Christmas and not being able to charge their cars. And since then, it's just rumbled on and got bigger and bigger in lots of different publications. You know, and I'm not just talking, it's not just the Daily Mail. There's been a lot of it in the Times. There's been pieces in the Sun and the Telegraph where they're reporting on a more negative side. And because there's a lot of early adopters who really love EVs, they think the national press are massively against EVs, which they might be. You know, is there someone behind the scenes pulling the strings? And this is the question: is there some lobbying groups who don't want EVs to be successful, or is the national press just reporting on what is actually happening out there? And I think it's probably the latter.
Yeah, I think it is that, and also a lot of newspapers in this vein have been reporting on this sort of stuff. No offense, Ray, if you're listening, but these newspapers, like, they will generate whatever headline is going to sell a newspaper, won't they? And when it's a divisive subject, they've got to decide, oh, right, we're going to take one side or the other. They've chosen the side of fear from people that EVs coming are going to ruin their lives. And that's why they're reporting on it in the way that they are. That's my feeling on it.
Let's ask Nick what he thinks, because we've been ranting about it. I mean, Nick, have you spotted this? Do you think there is an agenda out there? And I mean, what's your take on it?
I think it's something everyone's got a strong opinion on. I hope I'm balanced in this, because I have an electric car and a 3-litre diesel. So should be fairly well balanced in this. The green agenda, I think, is exactly like you said, John. People don't care when money matters. I heard someone say the reason that India and Bangladesh and Africa, for instance, aren't causing so much global warming issues is because if you've got to choose between feeding your family and caring about the planet, you're going to feed your family. And, you know, we're certainly not in that situation generally in this country, but people are finding things hard, and therefore money will always matter more than green issues, I'm afraid. I think the other thing to look at is these big national newspapers, if there is an agenda, and I'm not saying there is, have other interests outside of press. And, you know, EVs will strip a lot of money out of the economy. So there's already calls, like there is within the article, for 5% VAT on public charging rather than home charging. Well, if you compare 5% VAT to the VAT and other taxes on fuels, that's a huge amount being stripped out straight away. You've then got, for our industry specifically, repairs on EVs. This is going to come well after 2030. But repairs on EVs are realistically limited to either cheap things like the four corners or huge things like batteries and motors. So the repair networks, and going back to kind of linked with agency, if agency comes in and dealers are going to look at after sales instead, well, if repairs are going to be then be much smaller and less frequent servicing, then that gets stripped out as well. So I think the long-term economic vision has to be considered here as well. And that could be where the negative press is potentially coming from.
Yeah. Very interesting. I think it's a topic that's definitely going to rumble on, but I'm glad that we sparked some debate with this article, John. It's certainly, some would say, kicked off online.
Because there's one thing that there's not enough of at the minute, it's debate around EVs.
Yes, true. Right, I'm going to move on. I'm going to pick a story. So I was just looking at another tweet from Ray Massey, who seems to be absolutely spamming me with tweets at the moment, backing up his stories. Anyway, I am moving on to news from Lookers, that big listed car dealer group that has been the subject of a takeover from, or a potential takeover, I should say, from a Canadian group called Alpha Auto Group. That's their bid-in vehicle. They put a bid in, as we know, earlier last month, for Lookers for $464 million, offering 120 pence per share. But that's hit the rocks this week. Yesterday, Cinch, their largest shareholder, owned by Constellation Automotive Group, of course, the owners of BCA, We Buy Any Car, Marshalls, they withdrew their support for the deal. So they own just shy of 20% of Lookers. Lookers need 75% of its shareholders to back this deal for it to go through. And unfortunately, with Cinch pulling out their support, the Lookers board now thinks that they haven't got the support for this to go through. The vote is set to take place next Thursday, handily while I'm on holiday, so good luck with that for the rest of the team who are left here. But the vote's set to go through next week, which they're still going to do. They're still going to do that vote, but they don't think the actual deal will get the approval needed. So this has led to speculation since then. I've spoken to a number of sources that suspect another deal is coming. People that I spoke to said that they think Cinch has seen details of a better offer, and that's why they've pulled support. Rewind the clock back to when this was actually offered. Schroders was one of the shareholders that gave irrevocable undertakings that they would back this deal. They've since sold all of their shares, so that's now null and void. But at the time that they said, we'll back this deal unless one comes in at 132 pence. So they actually named a price. So we spoke to analysts at the time, including some very senior people at Liberum, who said that they think actually Lookers is worth, Lookers is worth closer to 150 pence a share. They've got cash in the bank at the end of April, their last financial year, which I'm sure has probably improved. Property portfolio worth £290 million, which was actually equivalent of 92 pence per share. So the 120 pence offer was cheap, and everybody said at the time it was cheap, and it was a bit of a bargain that they were getting. So I'm not surprised that this is falling apart. I am absolutely confident another deal will come through. I say absolutely confident. I think it's very highly likely another deal will be offered, and I think it will be closer to that 132 pence. I reckon it will be closer to 135 pence. The name that we've got on the website is Lithia Motors. As we know, this is a business that bid for Pendragon last year, was blocked by Hedin are Pendragon's, one of Pendragon's largest shareholders. It was blocked by them. Hedin eventually made their own offer for Pendragon, and we know how that went. Didn't go through. We know Lithia's got form. We know that they've got the funds, where they are very well funded. We know that they are looking to grow hugely, that we know that they like the UK market. They've already bought Jardines not long ago for £300 million. So actually, a deal for Lookers at 500 million, 550 million would actually be very good value when you compare it to the likes of Jardine that they've bought. Lots more dealer sites that Looker owns. So actually, if you put those two businesses together, actually, you've got a very, very substantial business that gives Lithia a very good foothold in the UK. So I wouldn't be surprised if that offer came about. Whether it comes before next Thursday's deadline will remains to be seen. If it doesn't come before next Thursday, that deal's not going to go through. I can't see that vote going in Looker's favour. It will remain a listed business, and then there will be right for the taking. Everybody knows what the price is that will get Looker's board over the line. 120 pence was what it was. 135 pence is definitely going to snatch it. So I think there's a lot to play out yet on this yet, John. I think there's lots of people out there with money that are looking to invest into good UK businesses. UK businesses look cheap. We know that. 120 pence, they were cheap. And I think there's a lot of legs left to run on this story.
Well, interestingly, I don't want to say I told you so because you weren't here, but last week I very briefly and poorly touched on the story of Lithia looking for new investment. So as soon as I saw this, I thought, oh, yes, good. We reported on that together. Sort of. Yes. So I will say you've also provided a very handy table at the bottom of this of potential suitors, haven't you, for Lithia? Which has some interesting names in it. I notice you haven't, no Constellation in there in terms of, you don't think Constellation would take them on in addition to Marshall?
I think, no, we did have.
To actually increase their,
So at the end, we've got private investment bankers might see Lookers as a bargain and be interested in taking them private. I said private equity has form with TDR Capital owning Constellation Automotive Group, which owns the previously listed Marshall Motor Group. So they could put a bid together to go for a Lookers again. Maybe that's why that they bought the blocking stake in the first place. However,
they don't seem to have the appetite though.
I don't think it's going to happen, John. I think they've. This is a personal opinion. I think they've had their fingers burnt with Marshalls. I don't think that's worked out quite as well as they thought it was going to. They've lost a lot of those franchises since. A lot of the manufacturers have gone, hang on a minute, we didn't sign up to this. Out you go. They've just lost all the Toyota Lexus businesses, which we know Dash paid a lot of money for when he bought Motorline to plug them into the larger Marshall business. They've lost those. I just think the manufacturers would go crazy if Lookers and Marshalls were put together in Constellation. So I can't see that happening. I think in this story I'd written the chance of a bid was 6 out of 10, but now I'd say that's probably closer to 2 out of 10. I just can't see that happening. I think Lithia Motors is probably the highest chance of a bid coming from them. But who knows? There might be a bid from someone else. What do you reckon, Nick?
I think you've pretty much covered it. But yeah, I think it's easy to look at that headline and think, is there a problem there? I think it's just a new opportunity or opportunities for Lookers, and they're going to maximise the value of their business, and fair play to them.
Because the way I look at that is, since we're getting, they bought that investment, they were making a decent return at 120. If someone came in and offered 125, it's not going to move the needle enough. But if someone comes in and or if they've seen an offer that someone's preparing at 135, they think, well, actually, yeah, that is worth causing a bit of upset now, holding on to the stake and getting a few million more pounds for my stake a little bit further down the line. So there's something going on. We asked, as part of this story, we asked Constellation Automotive Group for a comment. They declined, unsurprisingly. So we will see how this plays out over the next week.
I hope you're invited to the Christmas party, because you may well have helped them to push this up further by reporting on it so clearly. So,
I will report that so when the news broke yesterday, the share price crashed to 98 pence. Lookers, after we published our story, it recovered to 115 pence. So, you know, I don't know whether that was our story, but perhaps it might have been helping the Lookers shareholders get a little bit back that they'd lost during the day. I'm gonna say it was.
Yeah, shame we didn't purchase any shares before you.
Well, we're not allowed to, John, are we?
No,
so we wouldn't do that. Right, over to you, sir.
I will move us on to JLR and their new Gigafactory, which is, in the grand scheme of things for the UK, quite big news. So there was this umming and ahhing as to whether Jaguar Land Rover, JLR, whatever you want to call them this week, whether they were going to set up their new battery plant in the UK, as is their home, or in Spain, where I'm not quite sure why it was Spain. I assume it was something to do with some nice tasty grants from a government or the EU. But I think the UK government was under quite a lot of pressure to actually get this over the line in the UK. And we suspect, and the industry suspects, have spent quite a lot of money on, and in terms of grants and easing the transition for JLR to build this in the UK. But it has
definitely not backhanded.
No, no. I'm going to pause there because my front door is gone.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to take over for you, John, because your front door's gone. But also the story that I wanted to mention about JLR, and although this is very, very important and it's very, very good news that has taken place, I just wanted to pick up a story and add it on from last week, which was the Goodwood Festival of Speed. Jaguar Land Rover had a stand there that looked very much like one of their dealerships, but there was no mention of Land Rover on it.
That means it wasn't like their dealerships, because all their dealerships are going to have the Land Rover badge, James.
Apparently so, John. But the I asked them that question at the time, you know, why hasn't it got Land Rover on it? And actually, we had people on the ground at Goodwood and asked them to go and have a little look around. Is there any Land Rover brand in anywhere? I said. And even on the spec sheets for the Range Rover and the Defender and the Discovery, there was no mention of Land Rover on them at all. So all of this stuff I've been told that Land Rover is going to be this trust mark. It's going to underpin our brand. It's going to still be on the front of our buildings. It's still going to be on our cars. Well, the first opportunity they had to show off how they were going to do it at the Goodwood Festival of Speed in front of all of these car nuts is nowhere to be seen. So I am a little bit concerned about what that means.
Do you know what? I'm going to come out and say I don't think it really matters.
Really? I think it's a travesty that they're getting rid of Land Rover. I mean, you've got Chinese brands that are coming to the UK that would absolutely kill for a brand with a 100-year history like Land Rover, and they're just sweeping it under the carpet like it doesn't even
matter. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a strange decision. Which they may live to regret. I don't know, but I think they're trying to. I don't really know what they're trying to do, but all the time that they are Jaguar Land Rover, they're trying to not turn around their image, but they're trying to reformat the business in some way, aren't they? And they just feel perhaps that by making it less, having less brand names floating around, they're going to make it easier somehow. I will say, in photos of that Goodwood stand, I thought it looked, I think they're trying to, it's supposed to look really simplified. Yes. And clean and whatever. I thought it looked a bit sort of, no offense to anyone listening who happened to design that particular building, but I thought it looked really nothingy and plain, and it looked like there was meant to be a big JLR logo on it or a Land Rover logo, and it was missing. That's what it was for me.
Yeah, above the door. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think perhaps they were trying to make it look like an Apple store, and in fact it just looked like a sort of grey warehouse. Yeah, it didn't really work for me.
No.
So I hope that's not a look of things to come. I mean, I will say I don't particularly think that the dealership aesthetic they've got at the minute, this grey square where they've got JLR all bundled in together, I don't think that draws anyone in either. I mean, every time I see a new Starbucks or something being built, I think, oh, is that a new Jaguar Land Rover dealership? Because it's just a big grey square in a car park. There's not actually much going on with it, you know, like, if you look at some other brands' CIs, they've actually, I don't think it's wrong to add a bit of color, for example, to the outside of a building. Otherwise, it does start to look like an Amazon warehouse.
I think if you look at Porsche, for instance, you've got their, you know, new showroom concepts, you know, where they've made it, what they call it, destination Porsche now, isn't it? You know, they've got different demonstration areas. When you go into a Range Rover, it's going to be a Range Rover showroom now, isn't it? Rather than JLR showroom. You know, it just looks like a normal showroom, but very soulless. You know, they want—I'm guessing they want the products to sell themselves. But I think if you're going to streamline that down, you're going to have to focus a lot more on the technology and those products individually than you are just like you say, a great box.
I think I must say that the JLR told us this was not a showroom concept, but it was good. It was the first public outing for how this new house of brands is going to work. So, I mean, they can say all they want that it's not what their showrooms are going to look like, but it was the first opportunity for the public and at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, car nuts to actually see how this is going to become a reality.
You know, but what I think was a good CI, corporate identity for the deal.
Daewoo.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that wasn't where I was going. I was going to say the Land Rover one that they had about 15, 20 years ago, where it was all very off-roadery. And I remember my parents going to buy a Freelander, their second Land Rover, and there was an off-road sort of course at the dealership.
You were taken round it
in by the salesman, and he would show the hill descent control all worked and all that sort of stuff. And you would come away going, oh yeah, this car's really good. Yeah. Like, it's all these things I'm never ever going to use, but I know it's definitely a real Land Rover. And that is sort of disappearing. Like, you've probably been in a few JLR. Well, I know you've been in a few JLR launches, James, because I've been with you. But you know, when the last Range Rover Sport came out, they were, what's the word? They were adamant that it does all the things that a Land Rover should do. They were, but it's a Land Rover first, and not a Land Rover first, but they are adamant that any product that they release has to be able to do all these off-roadery things that Land Rovers have always had to do,
including driving it for a 747.
Yes, exactly. Yes. That's a very typical Land Rover thing to do. But it's all that sort of stuff of, like, you know, they've all got really, the wading depth kept getting higher and higher. And I think on the Range Rover it is the maximum it can be without the car getting washed away down a river. That's sort of 900 mil or something. There's all these things no Range Rover customer driving around Chelsea is ever going to use. But that is my one fear of, if the logo disappears, are they going to lose this brand identity of, it still has to do all these really off-roadery things, or is it just going to be like become a shiny SUV like all the other shiny SUVs that is great on road? Well, I say great on road, is good on road, but can't do all the off-roadery things that Land Rover always like to brag they could do.
I think it's going to be, it is going to be interesting to watch how this one plays out, because I think it's such a departure of what they were doing before. It is a big step they're doing, and they're betting the house on it, aren't they? Really, that it's going to work. So I will be interested to see what happens. But you have stolen all of my stories now, John. So I'm out.
Oh, well, I mean, we're running out of time, but I am going to squeeze one more in, which is a story from a week ago, but we didn't cover it because it was just after we'd recorded the podcast. And it's new to Suzuki. Suzuki has been named again the top automotive brand for customer service. So this is the seventh time Suzuki has been top of the Institute of Customer Service list for motoring brands. So I think this is a list of, they've listed 26 car manufacturers that are the top of the list. I think they do stuff outside of automotive as well. So it's 22nd overall across all measured sectors. So the 22nd most good customer service brand in the whole of the UK across everything, Apple and BT. I don't know why I said BT, but et cetera, is Suzuki.
Definitely not BT, John. Definitely not BT. They're not on the list.
No, they're not on the list. But yes, so Suzuki, top marks for customer service. And I always think every time this story comes up, and I will continue to talk about it every time it comes up, what it's indicative for me of is how important small local dealerships are to customer service, and how much easier it is to provide good customer service when you are a little dealership, probably family owned. You know, if you think about all the Suzuki dealers across the UK, there's some big names, but there's a lot of small local dealers. And there's also a lot of dealers. Suzuki have a lot of dealer representation. They don't appear to be in any way going, oh, we really need to consolidate our number of partners because it's getting a bit expensive, this. They have a lot of dealers and they are generally quite small, and they're not too showy either. They are just a dealership in a town, and people will continue to go and buy cars from there over and over again because of, presumably, they've got a relationship with that particular dealer. So I think in the years of agency sales, which of course Suzuki didn't reply to us on, but Dale Wyatt has been quite adamant that he's not a fan of agency sales, listed reasons why, I think customer service is doing quite well.
So what you're basically saying is this is all down to Robin Luscombe.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm sure he'd take that as well.
Absolutely. I'm sure he is one of the, he's definitely one of the dealers providing excellent customer service. Yes. But yes.
Very impressive results for Suzuki though. I know, I agree. Especially considering there's a lot of brands out there that also do it very well. So the fact that they come out on top and consistently so is not to be sniffed at.
Absolutely. So no more stories from you then, James.
No.
So Nick, Are there any stories you think we've missed this week?
No, I think you hit all the big ones I expected you to be honest. And, you know, I think especially the investigative pieces, let's call the reporting pieces, were really powerful this week and made really interesting reads.
You're saying all the right things.
Yeah, thank you.
Trying to get another invite. I've enjoyed it.
Anytime. So I'm going to have to ask, who do you think is the winner?
I think just because he actually jumped in and stole your Jaguar Land Rover story to add to his, James has managed to steal the thunder this week.
Excellent, because you had to answer the door.
Yeah, it was the door. It was the postman's fault.
Thank you, Mr. Postman.
Appallingly, it was actually my neighbour who I'd accepted a parcel for, so I shooed him away. So I'd be getting a Christmas card from him.
You just threw it, opened the door, threw it at him, slammed the door, and ran back. Goodbye. You were back pretty quick.
Yeah, didn't take long. Well, okay, well, that's galling news, obviously, but I won't hold it against you, Nick. It's been lovely to have you on, and I do hope you'll come back again. And hopefully you have a nice, quiet remainder of the month.
We won't, but thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Does that, John, does this mean that Jane Spatula's back on next week?
No, we have, as currently, we have a mystery co-host next week. So we'll...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Look forward to seeing who that is. It might just be me putting on a different voice.
Please let that be the case.
Well, on that very strange note, all that's left for me to say is thank you to Nick for judging. It's been great to have you on. And thank you as well to James for competing. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you're listening on Spotify, don't forget you can swipe up now and vote on who you think won. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, click the links below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Well, you'll find many, many stories as usual. And also don't forget about our other podcast, Car Dealer Inspiring Leaders, chaired by the very talented James Baggett, who's usually here. And apart from that, thanks again. Until next time, goodbye.